even more pensive and quiet than usual, as if he had something on his mind. "You're sure you want to go away?" I asked. Some of our friends' kids had started their college careers at community colleges closer to home, and I wanted to remind him that there were other options. "I definitely want to go away," he said, sounding decisive. I nodded, believing I understood. He was nervous, naturally, but ready, too. I think now he was talking about his own death. A couple of days later, we got written confirmation of the early diversion termination. In his final report, dated February 3rd, Dylan's counselor wrote, "Prognosis, good. Dylan is a bright young man who has a great deal of potential. If he is able to tap his potential and become self-motivated, he should do well in life." Recommendations. Successful termination. Dylan has earned the right for an early termination. He needs to strive to self-motivate himself so he can remain on a positive path. He is intelligent enough to make any dream a reality, but he needs to understand that hard work is part of it. I finally allowed myself to exhale. Dylan was back on track. Maybe I had been overreacting by worrying so much about the theft. Boys did dumb stuff, as everyone said. Dylan's journals tell a different story. By that point, things had decidedly taken a turn for the worst. Given the chance to travel back in time, I would ransack every nook and corner of my children's rooms, looking not just for drugs or goods we hadn't bought, but for any window onto their inner lives. There is nothing I wouldn't give to have read the pages of Dylan's journal while he was still alive, while we still had the chance to pull him back from the abyss that swallowed him and so many innocent others. Later in February, Dylan and I had a conversation about his senior year coming to an end, and he mentioned a senior prank. Assuming the whole class was involved, I asked him for details. He smiled and said he did not want to tell me. He and Tom loved practical jokes, but the thought of a senior prank made me nervous. The diversion counselor had been clear. Even the smallest and most insignificant infraction, like toilet papering a house on Halloween, could jeopardize Dylan's future. If he made another mistake, he'd have a felony on his record. "Don't even think about it," I warned him. He said, "Don't worry, Mom. I promise I won't get into trouble." Diversion was officially over, but Dylan had one last appointment with his counselor, so I called and asked him to please make sure Dylan understood the seriousness of the situation he was in. I didn't want him to take part in anything at school that might get him into more of a mess, no matter how silly, and not even if he did it with the entire senior class. His diversion counselor spoke to him about it at their last appointment and made the rules clear. Dylan never mentioned the topic of a prank to us again. Journal entry, February 1999. "Geez, I'm stuffed. We just got back from dinner with Eric Harris and his parents. We went there to celebrate the end of diversion for Eric and Dylan. Just hope they will stay out of trouble now for a year so their records are expunged, whatever that means. My, I remember what we were going through a year ago." We met Eric's family on the second day of February at a local steakhouse. It had been nearly a year since we'd seen them. The six of us sat in two adjacent booths, with the four parents in one booth, Eric and Dylan in the next. When Eric's mom said they weren't sure what his plans were, I chirped that Dylan would be leaving for college in the fall. Secretly, I was relieved Dylan had a more concrete plan than Eric did. I will forever be humbled by the foolishness of my pride. Mid-February, Dylan came downstairs dressed to go to work, though he wasn't scheduled. Eric's dog Sparky was seriously ill, so Dylan had picked up Eric's shift at Blackjack. I was fond of the little dog and felt sad for Eric. It's hard to lose a pet, especially an animal you've grown up with. As he left the house, I gave Dylan a hug and told him how proud I was that he was such a responsible employee and a good and loyal friend. Later that week, the two of us looked at degree requirements for the schools he'd been accepted to, and we both revved up when we saw all the classes he could take. Tom grappled with financial aid forms while Dylan and I began to plan college visits. One night, at the end of February, I surprised Tom and Dylan by bringing home a couple of fruit pies and Seven Samurai, a classic Japanese film from the 1950s, directed by Akira Kurosawa. Dylan had heard about Seven Samurai in a class at school and was curious about it. I'd never seen it, although I knew the American Western remake from the 60s, The Magnificent Seven. Snowy and cold outside, it seemed like the perfect night to light a fire, pig out, and watch a movie. But I worried about my choice as soon as the film began. I wasn't sure Dylan was going to stick around for a long, black-and-white, subtitled movie about a 16th-century Japanese village. I was wrong. Dylan was spellbound. We all were. Poor Byron dropped in for an unexpected visit in the middle, and even though we couldn't understand a word of the Japanese dialogue, we shushed him when he tried to talk. He sat down and tried to get into it with us, but he had the reaction I'd expected from Dylan. In a matter of minutes, he'd kissed me on the top of the head and let himself out. Rapt, we barely looked up long enough to say goodbye. After the closing credits rolled, Tom, Dylan, and I stayed up late on the couch, talking about some of the more remarkable scenes. Because he'd made videos and done sound for plays, Dylan had deep appreciation for the technical challenges the movie presented. He was particularly knocked out by a complicated choreographed battle scene staged in a downpour, which I would come to learn had inspired directors like Martin Scorsese. I was thrilled he'd appreciated the subtle artistry of the film. The first week of March, Dylan said he and some friends were going to go to the mountains to do an assignment for his video production class. Tom was scheduled for yet another surgery that week to replace his right shoulder joint. I asked Dylan who was going on the trip and who would be driving. I had not met two of the kids he mentioned. March is still winter in Colorado, and I reminded him to bring warm clothing, food, and water in case of a weather emergency. When I kissed him goodbye, I made him promise he wouldn't trespass. It was public land, he assured me. One of the boys knew the area well. He told me they were making an action film in a natural setting using toy guns. In truth, they were filming the Rampart Range video, which I did not see or even know about until we were deposed 4 years after the tragedy. In it, Dylan, Eric, and Mark Manis, the man who sold them one of the guns, shoot the weapons they have stockpiled. On March 11th, I took the day off so the three of us could visit the college in Colorado that Dylan had been accepted to. He was not overly enthused about the visit. He claimed to be intent on moving to a desert climate, but I was pleased to note he became more engaged when we took a tour of the computer lab. His academic performance in high school had always been a little mysterious to us. For someone who had shown so much early promise, he hadn't excelled. Watching him on that campus, I felt sure he was going to thrive at college. That evening, Tom and I attended parent-teacher conferences at Dylan's high school. We'd received a midterm report the previous week showing that Dylan's grades had dropped precipitously in calculus and English. I was pretty sure it was senioritis, a high school senior goofing off after being accepted to college, but wanted to touch base. Dylan's calculus teacher told us Dylan sometimes fell asleep in class and had not turned in some assignments. He'd taught Dylan before and was disappointed Dylan wasn't more motivated. I was bothered to hear Dylan was slacking off, but not alarmed. "Is he being disrespectful to you?" I asked. The teacher replied with amusement, "Oh, no, not Dylan. Dylan's never disrespectful." I wondered aloud if being a year younger than his classmates explained his immature attitude, or if he was blowing off the subject because he planned to take it again at college. Then I worried I was making excuses for Dylan, and I shut up. When I told the math teacher Dylan had been accepted at the University of Arizona, he seemed impressed and slightly surprised. When we mentioned the other Arizona university, he laughed and said, "Oh, yes. That's where all the jocks go after they flunk out of UCLA." We later shared this comment with Dylan, who changed his mind about visiting the school. The upshot of our meeting was that Dylan wouldn't fail the course if he went to class and turned in the overdue assignments. We sat down with Dylan's English teacher next. She'd taught both of my sons, and I felt a comfortable familiarity with her. I was relieved to hear Dylan had turned in some missing assignments after she'd sent out the midterm report, and his grade had moved from a D to a B. His teacher also praised Dylan's writing abilities. Tom and I were happily surprised. We'd always thought of Dylan as a math kid and Byron as the son with the talent for language. After this praise, the tone of the conversation shifted, and she told us Dylan had turned in a disturbing paper. Tom remembers the word she used as shocking, because he wondered if it was a reference to sexual content. We asked for details, but she only said the paper contained dark themes and some bad language. To illustrate the inappropriateness of Dylan's composition, she told us about a paper Eric had written from the first-person perspective of a bullet being shot from a gun. Eric's story, she told us, could have been violent, but when it was read aloud, the class was amused. Dylan's story, on the other hand, was dark. It had no humor in it at all. Her comments on the paper, which I did not see until a year later, read as follows. I'm offended by your use of profanity. In class, we had discussed the approach of using special characters, like the dollar sign, exclamation point. Also, I'd like to talk to you about your story before I give you a grade. You are an excellent writer, storyteller, but I have some problems with this one. During our conference, Tom asked, Is this something we should be concerned about? Dylan's teacher said she thought it was under control. She'd asked Dylan to do a rewrite and planned to show the original to Dylan's guidance counselor. Since I never wanted to leave a meeting without an action plan, I asked, So one of you will call us if you think this is a problem? She confirmed they would. She did show the paper to Dylan's counselor, who chided him about the language. I had the opportunity to meet with the counselor after the tragedy. He was understandably stricken by his failure to recognize an incipient threat. The professionals I have spoken to are divided on whether Dylan's paper, and possibly Eric's, would today qualify him for a screening in a public school system with a threat assessment protocol. It's entirely possible that both would have gone unremarked. Teenage boys often write disturbingly about guns and violence. True threat assessment, though, is all about assembling disparate clues to arrive at a full picture. And it's likely that Dylan's arrest, his suspension in junior year, and the disturbing paper would together have added up to a red flag. We did not perceive the paper to be a red flag, though, and the events of the rest of the night contributed to diminish the relative importance of it. Since no one else was waiting to talk to the English teacher, we continued to visit with her. I mentioned a presentation I'd seen about the differences between generations X and Y children. We chatted about the district's language arts curriculum and one of the required reading books, A Prayer for Owen Meany. We were all roughly the same age, and the three of us mused about what it had been like to be young during the Vietnam War. This prompted Dylan's teacher to share a story. She'd brought a folk record from the 60s, Four Strong Winds, into class. The song featured the hardships faced by migrant farm workers, and it had always made her cry. But her students had laughed when she played it. Tom and I leaned forward with concern. Did Dylan laugh, too? She told us he had. I was bitterly disappointed. He often watched classic movies with us, and I would have expected better. Tom and I apologized for the insensitivity of our son and his classmates, and the three of us commiserated over the youth of today, like old-timers sitting on a park bench. We shook hands warmly when we parted. It was Dylan's reaction to the song, not the paper, that Tom and I talked about on the way home. I hated that he'd laughed when his teacher shared a piece of art that moved her. Tom could never part with old books, science journals, or car parts, and his piles of junk ordinarily drove me nuts. That night, though, I appreciated his idiosyncrasies as he dug out the old record. We sat in the living room with a cup of tea, and I gave myself over to the song's melancholy refrain. Tom saw an opportunity to teach Dylan a lesson and to have a bit of fun, too. When he heard Dylan's car coming up the driveway, he queued up the record. When Dylan came in, we told him about the meetings with his teachers. Tom remembers that we talked about the paper during that discussion and asked him to get it for us. I don't remember asking for the paper until the following morning. As we talked, Tom hit play. Eventually, Dylan recognized the song coming up in the background. Knowing he'd been set up, he started to laugh. "Why are you playing that horrible song?" "Why is it horrible?" I asked him. He said he hated the weird sound of it. We told him what the song was about. "Just listen to it with an open mind," Tom requested. Without protest, Dylan listened to the rest of the song. When it was over, he admitted it wasn't that bad. We told him how hurt his teacher had been and talked about the importance of respecting the feelings of others. He admitted it had been wrong to laugh. Afterward, the three of us curled up on the couch to watch one of our favorite movies, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. As we headed off to bed, Tom and I felt we had provided the best guidance we could. I will never know if Dylan was pretending to care or if he did. The next morning, I asked Dylan to show me the English paper. He said it was in his car and that he didn't have enough time to look for it. I said, "Well, I'd like to see it when you get home from school today. When will you be home?" He said, "I won't have time today because I have to work." I gave him a look that said, "Stop making excuses," and added with finality, "I want to see the paper. You can show it to me tonight when you get home." He said he would, but by the time evening came, Tom and I had both forgotten about it. This lack of follow-through on my part was uncharacteristic, but indicative. I believed Dylan was a psychologically healthy human being. I never considered that the paper could be a reflection of deeply seated problems. I knew it contained some rough language and a dark theme, but had confidence that his teacher and the school counselor would handle the situation appropriately. If anything, I was interested in taking a look at Dylan's writing skills. I finally saw Dylan's paper for the first time more than a year after his death. A copy of the story was among some of the items returned to us by the sheriff's department. The subject matter, a man dressed in black who kills the popular kids at a school, was indeed disquieting, but I cannot help but wonder if, as an artist myself, I would have seen it as a danger sign if I had read it before his death. Artistic expression, even when it's unpleasant, can be a healthy way of coping with feelings. I abhorred the violence so attractive to teenage boys. I could no more sit through an entire viewing of Pulp Fiction than lay an egg, but I never imagined Dylan would be capable of making that violence real. That spring, whenever Dylan wasn't busy and the world slowed down around him, I noticed how pensive and distracted he looked. A month or so before the shootings, I approached him one afternoon as he sat on the couch staring blankly into the middle distance. "You're so quiet lately, honey. Are you sure you're okay?" He stood up and said, "Yeah, I'm just tired and have a lot of homework to do. I'm going up to my room to get it done so I can get to bed a little early." "All right," I said. "You want me to make you something to eat?" He was also very thin in those last months. He ate well at home, but I wondered if he was getting enough when he wasn't there, and would often offer to make him French toast or an omelet between meals. He shook his head and headed upstairs. I returned to tidying the kitchen, trusting in the kid I'd raised, satisfied he knew he could tell me whatever was on his mind, and confident that he would do so in his own good time. It's not that I didn't know that something was wrong, but I had no idea it was a life-and-death situation. I was just worried Dylan was unhappy. There isn't a day since the tragedy that I haven't relived that interaction, but I don't see myself following him up the stairs. A faraway look. I have heard suicidologist Thomas Joyner refer to it as the thousand-yard stare. Is a warning sign for imminent suicide and one often missed. Hundreds of times I've imagined myself demanding, cajoling, wheedling, bribing Dylan. Tell me what's going on with you. Tell me what it feels like. Tell me what you need. Tell me how I can help. I've even imagined barricading myself in his room, refusing to leave until he tells me what he's thinking. Each one of these fantasies ends with me taking him into my arms, knowing exactly what to say and how to get him the help he needs. For my 50th birthday, I arranged to meet a friend for a drink after work. I told Tom not to worry if I was late. I suspected my friend might be planning a get-together. Indeed, I found a dozen close friends and co-workers at the restaurant, plus Tom, who'd organized the party. The fact that he'd done such a kind thing warmed me. As I settled in for a conversation with my friends, Tom leaned over and warned me not to fill up on snacks. "We're going out for dinner," he whispered. Dylan and Byron were waiting for us at home, dressed up and ready to go. Byron presented me with a houseplant, and Dylan gave me a CD. Ruth and Don met us at the restaurant, yet another surprise. I was as happy that night as I can remember being, completely oblivious to the terrible disaster looming on the horizon. Don took pictures as we were leaving the restaurant. Dylan had been quiet all evening, visibly self-conscious and uncomfortable as he always was in social situations, but polite and, as usual, happy to have a good meal. In the pictures, which I saw for the first time only after his death, he looks annoyed. Early the next morning, the three of us set off for Arizona. Although I'd slept barely a few hours, I was looking forward to spending time with Tom and Dylan. Tom relinquished the wheel to Dylan on the second day. We hoped to use the trip to help improve his highway skills. The first few hours were a trial. With his crooked glasses balanced on his nose and his baseball cap turned backwards, Dylan tilted the seat back in a semi-reclining position and drove with only the index finger of his left hand touching the wheel. I sat in the back seat, clutching the door handle and praying silently until I finally asked him to slow down. Tom tried to keep both of us calm, though I noticed he did not need his usual reminder to fasten his seatbelt. Little by little, Dylan's driving improved, and he ended up driving for several hours. Eventually, I was able to fall asleep, and when I woke up, Dylan was driving like a pro. He seemed pleased when I complimented him, though he was probably just happy I'd stopped nagging. He listened to techno CDs through earphones until Tom asked if he'd play something for us. Tom preferred jazz and I usually chose classical, so we were both surprised by how much we liked what he played. All of us were excited to see Colorado's mountains give way to the desert vegetation. When Tom took the wheel, Dylan grabbed the camera so he could take pictures out of the car window and said again how much he was looking forward to going to school in the desert. Our tour was successful, and by the end, Dylan had made up his mind. He wanted to go to the University of Arizona. We could skip the other school on our itinerary and head for home. We stopped for gas and asked Dylan to pose next to a saguaro more than three times his height. He looks remote and unkempt in the photo, developed after his death, standing with his arms uncomfortably out from his sides. To me, now, they look poised over invisible guns. At our hotel, Dylan watched a movie in his room while Tom and I made an early night of it. The next morning, as we were all getting ready to join civilization at the Continental breakfast, Dylan pulled his old baseball cap, one of his favorite possessions, over his long hair. We'd made the cap together. He'd carefully snipped the B for Boston Red Sox off another hat grown too shabby to wear, and I'd sewn the letter to the back of a new hat so he could wear it backwards and still display the logo. It turned out remarkably well, and he never wanted to be without it. Tom stepped in with his 1950s dress code standards and asked Dylan not to wear the hat to the hotel's breakfast buffet. Dylan argued that we were on vacation and it couldn't possibly make a difference to anyone if he wore the hat. I shot Tom a "don't sweat the small stuff" look, but didn't want to sabotage his authority, so I gathered up a suitcase. "I'll go down to the car and wait while you two work this out." I'd forgotten the car key, though, so I leaned against the hood in the cold morning air, remembering how Tom would insist the boys tuck in their shirts and polish their shoes for church while the minister's own kids wore T-shirts and jeans. I was angry at him for harping on the hat. I guess I still am. Eventually, Dylan came down to the car alone, his head bare. I wanted to say I agreed with him and that it was okay with me if he wore the hat, but I did not. I only said, "I'm sorry the morning started out like this. I see you decided not to wear the hat." Dylan sounded tired but determined to brush it off. "It's not worth fighting about. It's just not a big deal." I was frankly surprised. I'd expected a little more sputtering and complaining from a 17-year-old. "Wow, Dill, I'm impressed," I said, mistaking his willingness to withdraw from the conflict for maturity. I praised him for controlling his anger, but I wish now he had stomped and screamed, giving me a glimpse of the rage burning inside him. Now I wonder if he had stopped caring about anything at all. There was one more odd incident on our way home, which at the time Tom and I chalked up to Dylan's desire to get back to his friends. The three of us stopped at a packed McDonald's in Pueblo for a quick bite. A large group of teenagers had taken over a couple of tables against the wall. We'd just unwrapped our sandwiches when Dylan leaned forward, hardly moving his lips, and said urgently, "We have to go. Those kids are laughing at me." I looked over. The teenagers were hooting and hollering and having a great time, and none of them was paying the slightest bit of attention to us. "Relax, Dill. Nobody's looking at you," I said. Besides, I thought, if a person didn't want to be noticed, why wear a floor-length leather coat? But Dylan grew more insistent, casting quick, paranoid glances over his shoulder at the oblivious kids. He was so uncomfortable that we bolted our burgers and hustled out of there. The teenagers didn't even look up at us as we left. The rest of the ride home was uneventful. After our trip, Dylan jumped right back into his busy social life. Nate spent the night. One evening, after studying calculus with Robin, Dylan asked if I would help pay for prom expenses. I was floored he was interested in going to the prom at all. So, I found out later, were his friends. He seemed amused himself. The following night, March 30th, I attended a pre-graduation meeting for parents of seniors and ran into Judy Brown. Since our phone conversation about the snowball more than a year earlier, we'd seen each other only briefly, mostly after school productions, and so we were eager to catch up. Before long, our conversation veered off into our mutual interest in art, my figure drawing sessions, and some classes she'd taken. We looked at some drawings I had stashed in my car before saying goodbye. Neither one of us mentioned Eric. One of the most painful questions people ask suicide loss survivors is whether or not we ever hugged our kids. The question hurts, not only for the obvious reasons. Only thousands of times, what kind of mother doesn't hug her kid? But in my case, because of a specific incident, indeed a specific hug, that took place in the last 2 weeks of Dylan's life. One afternoon, we passed each other in the hallway at the foot of the stairs. Spontaneously, I threw my arms around him. "I love you so much," I told him. "You are such a wonderful person, and Dad and I are so proud of you." He rested his left hand gently on my back, barely touching me. With the jokingly haughty air we sometimes use to thank each other for elaborate and ridiculous compliments, he thanked me. But I didn't want him to make a joke of this, which I meant with all my heart, and so I took his thin jawbone in both of my hands and looked directly into his eyes, No kidding around, Dylan. I mean it. I love you so much. You are a wonderful person, and Dad and I are proud of you. He looked down, embarrassed, and whispered his thanks. For years, I replayed this scene in my mind. Afraid that it would become distorted through repetition, I wrote it down. I can see it like a movie now. Two figures in the hallway, his hand on the small of my back, me reaching up to hold his face. The memory of that hug is one of the most painful I hold, and the knowledge that, to this day, I have no idea what on earth Dylan could possibly have been thinking. On April 4th, I decided to whip up a belated last-minute dinner in honor of the combined Easter and Passover holidays, figuring I'd scrunch the two and make it a double celebration, as my family had often done when I was a child. When I mentioned it to Dylan, he laughed in an irritated way, as if at some private joke, and told me he didn't want to attend. He gave in when I asked him to reconsider. I spent a happy day in the kitchen cooking, and a neighbor joined us for the meal. We never did get all the way through the service, but we had a good time. The family celebrated Tom's birthday in early April by going out for fondue. Byron and Dylan took one car, and Tom and I rode in another, giving the boys some time to bond. It was the last time Byron was alone with his brother, and he would later tearfully recall how normal Dylan had acted. At dinner, Byron did most of the talking. Dylan was so quiet, I fretted he wasn't getting enough attention, an old worry, familiar to many parents, that one child will feel less loved or validated than the other one. Dylan did get a few jokes in, one so funny I laughed about it all evening. Later, when I couldn't remember what the joke was, neither Tom nor Byron could remember either. I was crushed that I hadn't paid more attention. After dinner, the four of us gathered back at the house for homemade cake and gifts. I'd found Tom a small concrete bench, a place to rest his sore joints while tending to his favorite flowers, and my two sons carried it into the garden from the trunk of my car. Byron gave him a CD, and Dylan gave him a box of little cigars. For many years, he smoked one on Dylan's birthday in remembrance. 4 days before the tragedy, I saw the Toulouse-Lautrec exhibit with a friend at the Denver Art Museum, while Tom and Dylan studied a map of the University of Arizona to find the dorm closest to the center of campus and tried to figure out which rooms were the largest. After they were through, Dylan picked up his tuxedo. He hung the bag from his closet door to keep the contents from wrinkling. We would see it later in the background of one of the basement tapes. Tom and I both noticed Dylan was a little agitated that week. I was sure he was nervous about the prom. Robin was flying back to Denver on Saturday afternoon after an out-of-state church function, and her flight time would cut it close. Dylan had to choose flowers and work out the logistics of dinner and transportation. The tasks were, to say the least, out of his area of expertise. That Friday, Dylan asked if Eric could sleep over. We agreed. The guest room hadn't been cleaned since Nate had spent the night a couple of weeks earlier, and our sick cat Rocky had thrown up in there, so Tom and I wrestled a vacuum cleaner up the stairs and asked Dylan to clean the room and bathroom before his friend arrived. Dylan was irritated we were making such a big deal about cleaning. He told us Eric didn't care if the room was clean or not. I overrode his protests. Eric may not care, but we do. If you clean your room, Dad will do the bathroom and I'll do the guest room. It'll go fast if we all help. A few minutes later, Dylan left the house, saying he had a quick errand to run. I rolled my eyes, believing he was procrastinating. More likely, he was removing something he did not want us to see. After Dylan returned, we poked our heads into his room intermittently to check his progress. Neither one of us saw anything unusual. I'd already gone to bed when Eric arrived about 10 p.m. He had brought a large duffel bag, so heavy he could hardly lift it, and he was dragging it over the threshold when Tom said hello. Dylan and his friends were always hauling computer parts and video equipment over to one another's houses, so Tom didn't think twice about the bag. He told the boys what snacks were available, said good night, and came to bed. We slept without interruption, and when I came down to make breakfast, Eric had already gone. After all the fuss about cleaning the guest room, the bed had not been slept in at all. Journal entry, April 1999. We all focused on Dylan to get him ready for the prom. It was so cute. A came over and we took pictures. Robin and he left at about 6, and he has a big night ahead. On Saturday, April 17th, Tom and I remained on standby at home to help Dylan get ready for the prom. Dylan woke much calmer than the day before. He seemed to be going out of his way to convince me he wasn't nervous. When I asked if he was concerned Robin wouldn't make it from the airport in time, he shrugged and said, "It's no big deal. If we make it, we make it. If we don't, we don't. I'm not worried about it." Late afternoon, his hair still wet from his shower, Dylan hauled his tuxedo into our bedroom where we had a full-length mirror to work with. New to formal wear, he needed Tom's help to understand what all the tuxedo pieces were. Self-conscious in black socks, plaid boxer shorts, and a gleaming white shirt with a stiff pleated front, he seemed to tower over his father, though there was only a 2-inch difference between them. He stood patiently while Tom awkwardly twisted tiny pieces of metal and plastic through the many buttonholes. The bow tie stumped Tom, and Dylan wrestled it away to try it himself. Together, the two consummate problem solvers figured it out. I sat on the bed to keep them company and told Dylan he looked like Lee Marvin getting outfitted in Western finery in Cat Ballou, one of our family's favorites. Both he and Tom laughed. I had the camera, and Dylan tolerated a few shots before becoming self-conscious and annoyed as usual. I tried to catch one of his reflection in the mirror without him noticing, but he grabbed a towel and flicked it to block the shot. I developed the role a few months after his death, using an assumed name so the press wouldn't get a hold of the pictures. In that photo, only a fragment of his face is visible behind the towel, a mischievous grin under tired eyes. We'd spent that year begging Dylan to get a haircut to no avail, but I convinced him to tie his hair back into a ponytail with one of my own elastics for the prom. He put his prescription glasses in his pocket and donned a pair of small-framed sunglasses. We thought he looked very handsome. Allison, our renter, came over and offered to take a picture of the three of us. In the picture, Dylan is clowning around, hamming it up like a professional model, Zoolander style. The sharp lines of his formal wear stand in stark contrast to the faded flannel shirts and worn blue jeans Tom and I are wearing. He kept his sunglasses on as he posed with us. He wore dark glasses often during the last weeks of his life. I believe now he was hiding behind them. Tom had remembered to charge the batteries on our video camera, and he filmed Dylan briefly before Robin arrived. The conversation between them is stilted. Clearly, neither of them is comfortable on camera. But we have looked back on this pre-prom video many times and shown it to others. It is absolutely stunning how normal Dylan seems. He and Tom talk lazily about baseball. Dylan mimes his hero, Randy Johnson, pitching in an ill-fitting tuxedo. Tom makes some comment about growing up, and Dylan remarks he'll never have kids. Tom says he may change his mind, and Dylan says, "I know, I know. Someday I'll look back at this and say, what was I thinking?" It is breathtakingly prophetic. When Tom persists in filming over Dylan's protests, Dylan pinches small handfuls of snow from a nearby bush, lobbing the miniature snowballs playfully at Tom until the camera stops running. The fondness between them is palpable. It breaks my heart. Robin arrived in good time, looking lovely in a deep blue-purple dress. Tom taped Dylan, presenting her with her corsage, and smiling down at her as she struggled to pin a rose to his lapel. I made paparazzi jokes and asked them to move so I could get a picture without parked cars in the background. Since Dylan had assured us he and Robin were just friends, I was a little surprised and frankly tickled to see him put his arm around her. In the last few frames on the tape Tom shot, the two of them smile into the camera. Then, self-consciously but sweetly, they both begin to laugh. When I heard Dylan's car arrive home from the prom after 4 a.m., I roused myself to talk with him. Though I was tired, I wanted to reach out. We met at the foot of the stairs. He looked exhausted but happy, a kid who'd had a big night. As usual, he was reluctant to volunteer information, so I peppered him with questions about what he'd eaten and whom he'd hung out with. I was excited to find out he'd danced. He thanked me for paying for tickets and clothes, and I was pleasantly surprised by his effusiveness when he told me he'd have the best night of his life. I had kissed him goodnight and turned to go back to bed when he stopped me. "I want to show you something." He pulled a metal flask from his pocket. Someone with a little skill and a lot of solder had fixed a large crack at the top with a messy patch. "What is this?" I demanded. "Where did you get this thing?" He said he'd found it. When I asked what it contained, Dylan said it held peppermint schnapps and that he'd rather not say where he'd gotten the alcohol. I was about to launch into my well-worn concerns about drinking when Dylan held up a hand, silencing me. "I want you to know you can trust me and you can trust Robin. I had filled this so we could drink it tonight. I want you to see only a little tiny bit is missing." He handed me the flask and insisted I examine it closely, as if he were going to do a magic trick with it. "We had a little bit to drink at the beginning of the evening, but no more after that. See? It's close to the top." I acknowledged the flask was nearly full. "I just wanted you to know you can trust me," he said again. Still a little shaken, I thanked him for sharing the information with me before adding, "I do trust you." Then I headed off to bed, reassured. I'd never expected him to get through high school without experimenting with alcohol, after all. At least he'd told me about it. I've given a lot of thought to that private moment between mother and son in the stillness of the night. In retrospect, I sometimes think that engaging me in that conversation about the flask was among the cruelest tricks Dylan ever played on me. Was he consciously manipulating me into trusting him, even as he was planning a massacre? Was he mocking me? If he was preparing to die within a few days, why was it necessary to establish my trust in him? Did he need reassurance, or was he trying to prevent me from searching his room? I once shared these thoughts with a psychologist who then asked me, "How do you know he wasn't in earnest? Maybe he did want to earn your approval, and it had nothing to do with what was to follow." It's one of the many things I will never know. Sunday after the prom, Dylan slept late, then left for Eric's in the afternoon. He looked terribly tired, which was only to be expected after the sleepover on Friday night and a late night at the prom. I made a large kettle of homemade vegetable soup with pozole, but Byron had plans and Dylan didn't get home until later, so Tom and I ate alone. April 19th was a Monday, and Dylan let me know he wouldn't be home for dinner. He'd made plans to go to a steakhouse with Eric, the same restaurant where we had eaten with Eric's family 2 months earlier. "What's the occasion?" I asked. When Dylan ate with friends, they usually went for fast food. He told me Eric had a couple of coupons. They didn't need a reason, as far as I was concerned. 3 weeks from graduation, they were about to move on to the next phase of their lives, and I applauded their impulse to celebrate. I told Dylan to have a good time. He got home about 8:30, and I greeted him at the door. "How was it?" "Good," he said, as he removed his muddy shoes. Always trying to pull a little more information, I asked, "What did you have for dinner?" He looked up from his shoes, tilting his head to one side, so he could give me a "come on, Mom" look. They'd gone to a steakhouse. "A steak?" he said. We both laughed. Tom was reading in the living room, and I asked Dylan if he had time to sit down with us for a minute. But he said he had a lot of work to do, adding he'd probably have to be in his room all evening to get everything done. He seemed particularly evasive and eager to get upstairs. I assumed he had some last-minute end-of-year homework to finish up. The phone rang a few times. I let Dylan get it. I do not remember kissing him or going to his room to say goodnight. I am still trying to forgive myself for not remembering if I did or not. The next morning, I got up in the dark to get ready for work. Before I had the chance to call him for bowling, Dylan bounded down the stairs past our bedroom. I opened the door, trying to catch him before he left. The house was dark. I heard the front door open. "Dill?" I called into the darkness. "Bye," was all he said. Chapter 15. Collateral Damage. Journal Entry, January 2001. I truly see no reason to continue living. I have a mammogram on Wednesday. I'm even fantasizing about having a fatal disease so I could say, "How long do I have to stick around before I can get out of here?" I make no contributions to life and derive no pleasure from it. Fantasize about saving a child from disaster and dying in the process, or offering my life to terrorists to save a plane load of people. On Valentine's Day of 2001, almost 2 years after Dylan's participation in the massacre at Columbine High School, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. In a sense, I wasn't surprised. You know those Halloween costumes made to look like the handle of an axe is protruding from your chest? That was what I felt like all the time. The heart is where you hold and nurture a child, and a virtual bomb had been set off in mine. My son was dead, and 14 other people because of him. It made sense there would be some collateral damage. Fear of death had been a constant companion of mine since childhood, and an intensified version of it set in quickly after my diagnosis, adding to already sky-high levels of anxiety. A few days afterward, Tom took me out to our favorite neighborhood Chinese restaurant. At the end of the meal, when I broke open my fortune cookie, there was nothing inside. My oncologist approached me thoughtfully. Because they'd caught the cancer early, and because the tumor was small, she felt I might be able to do radiation treatment and avoid chemotherapy. Due to persistent stomach problems related to grief and anxiety in the wake of the tragedy, I had already lost about 25 pounds, weight I could not afford to lose. Grief and guilt had dramatically depleted my physical and emotional reservoirs. The treatment path was my choice, but the truth sat unspoken between us. I was so run down and haggard, I did not look like someone who would survive a brutal round of chemotherapy. I elected not to do it. There's a Susan G. Komen Cancer Outreach Program in our community. After your diagnosis, a breast cancer survivor comes to your house to give you information and encouragement. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a similar visitation program for suicide loss survivors called the Survivor Outreach Program. I'm on the board of our local chapter, currently working to bring that program to Colorado. When I saw the breast cancer support group information my volunteer had brought, I could only shake my head. I needed a support group, that was true, but not for cancer. Radiation causes exhaustion and physical discomfort, but I was already there. With the help of family and friends and a terrific medical team, I got through my treatment. After my final radiation session, the staff of the clinic presented me with a card they'd signed. It's likely this is a kindness they perform for every patient, but the gesture devastated me, and I fled to the safety of my car to cry. I didn't know why I was crying. maybe because it had felt so good to be taken care of, or because the end of my treatment meant I'd have to go back full-time to grieving for Dylan and struggling to understand what he'd done. It's funny I don't have more to say about surviving cancer. I certainly didn't feel detached or blasé about it when it was happening. It was treated, and I moved on with gratitude. But after I recovered, I realized I'd been wrong in the journal entry that begins this chapter. I did not want to die. Tom would often say he wished Dylan had killed us too, or that we'd never been born at all. I prayed I'd pass away in my sleep, a quiet deliverance from the agony of waking up and realizing it hadn't all been a terrible nightmare. Sitting in traffic, I'd fantasize about being given the opportunity to trade my life for the people who had died at the school, or being presented with the chance to sacrifice myself to save a large group. Dying would be a relief, I thought, and dying to save others would give my miserable life purpose. Surviving breast cancer helped me to see, as perhaps we all should, that my life was a gift. My work, going forward, would be to find a way to honor that gift. Chapter 16. A New Awareness. It's widely acknowledged among those who grieve that the second year is often worse than the first. The first year, you're trying to adjust to the newness of the suffering and to get through the days. It's during the second year that you realize you've lost sight of the shoreline. There's nothing but emptiness ahead and behind, a vast loneliness stretching out as far as you can see. This, you realize, is permanent. There will be no turning back. My grief was amplified by the agony of knowing that so many families were going through something similar because of my son. The image of Dylan, so hate and rage-filled on the tapes, battled with my own memories of the playful kid I'd loved so much. Some days, it felt like a war was taking place inside of me. A few things helped. I couldn't yet make art, but as I lay in bed, I would sometimes imagine I was drawing. Specifically, I imagined I was drawing trees. I have always loved trees. I'm inspired by their fortitude and character, their knots and scars and burls, the sites of so many injuries and so much life, and by their generosity, the way they uncomplainingly provide shade and oxygen and food and shelter and fuel. Trees are both deeply grounded and aspirational. They never stop reaching. They feel like friends, and the idea of drawing them became a safe and comforting place for me to park my mind. But I could not yet put pencil to paper. Indeed, I would not achieve the integration I sought until I found two nutrients essential to so many survivors. First, I found community, and then I found a way to contribute. Journal entry, July 1999. Met C. Her son D killed himself at 12 after a bad day at school. It was over a year and a half ago, and she still cries all the time. I cried hard all the way home and realized how much I want to be in a support group. We'll lock cats out tonight so I can sleep. Less than 3 months after the shootings, my supervisor sent me to a large regional conference for rehabilitation professionals. I debated about whether to go. While I had come to feel a little more comfortable with my coworkers, I wasn't sure I was ready to be out in the wider world. Ultimately, I asked the organizers to hold my name tag behind the registration table until I asked them for it. By then, such precautions had become a way of life. When I went to claim my badge, one of the two women behind the table looked up. "Sue Klebold?" she asked. I tensed, as I would for years. But the lovely, dark-haired woman reached across the table for my hand. "I'm Celia. I want you to know many people understand what you're going through right now." Her voice was warm, but she did not smile. When she continued, I understood why. My 12-year-old son died by suicide last year, she said. I had received an enormous amount of sympathy and many letters of commiseration. Our friends and my colleagues had been wonderful, but I always felt the distance between their experiences and my own. Celia's hand on mine and those words, "Many people understand what you're going through," tethered me back to the world, providing a deep and automatic consolation, the way a distraught toddler's tears stop as soon as he's swept up into his mother's arms. I asked Celia if she might have some time to sit and talk, and she told me she'd be relieved from the registration desk in half an hour. The next 30 minutes were wasted. I cried in the bathroom for half of it and walked around in a daze for the rest. My need to talk to another mother who had lost a child to suicide was even greater than I had known. When Celia reached out, I grabbed hold of what she was offering like I was grabbing for a rope mid-fall. We spent almost an hour in two plush chairs in the hotel lobby, holding hands and sharing. I was careful not to divulge specifics about Dylan that might put Celia in legal jeopardy. Meanwhile, her own story broke my heart. She'd lost her son so young. At least I had been able to see Dylan as a young man. I knew I wasn't the only mother who'd had absolutely no idea how troubled her beloved child had been. But I'd had few opportunities to feel the kinship that comes from talking to someone who has also lost someone to suicide. It helped that Celia was so pretty and well put together, so intelligent and articulate, the kind of woman I would have admired under any circumstances. Her sophisticated normality was a balm, as I had unwittingly bought into many of the ignorant myths about suicide. As we tearfully hugged goodbye, I felt closer to her than I felt to anyone in the world. "I can't imagine what you're going through," people would say, shaking their heads, and they were right. I say that without judgment. Who could imagine going through something like this? I certainly could not have. Surrounded as I was by love and support, I felt completely adrift from normal experience and indeed from myself. It was, I came to realize, how Dylan must have felt at the end of his life. There had been no relief for me on the horizon, no indication it would ever feel any different, until Celia put her hand on mine. With one gesture, she had connected me to a society of survivors who would welcome me without hatred or judgment. For the first time, I felt a gleam of hope that I might not have to spend the rest of my life spinning on my own solitary planet, grappling with feelings no one else could understand. Somewhere out there, there was a tribe of people who would see me as a sister, a partner, a soulmate, who would allow me to join them in making a contribution. In the second year after Dylan's death, I finally found that community. It had been painful to feel so profoundly alienated from the place where we had made our home. I had always chatted easily with the barista at Starbucks, and I knew the names of all the women at the supermarket checkout. After Columbine, I anxiously watched people's body language and facial micro-expressions to see whether they recognized me. Luckily, 99.9% of the people who did had something kind to say, but cringing like a frightened animal in the place where we'd made our home had shaken my sense of myself. Much has been written about what happened in Littleton in the wake of the tragedy. As humans go into shock after an assault on their bodies, so do communities. As President Clinton said on the night of the massacre, "If it could happen in a place like Littleton." This wasn't the drug-riddled inner city or some supposedly godless corridor like New York or Los Angeles. People who lived in Littleton were upstanding citizens with nice suburban houses and happy, healthy, well-fed children. We expected our schools to be safe. In the months after Columbine, everyone who lived in the area felt exposed and frightened. The whole place was a bundle of raw nerves, and people responded in all kinds of ways. Some tapped into a vein of forgiveness and compassion. Others lashed out. Many, who'd never had a voice before, gained a sense of power and importance. Some were seduced by it. Others genuinely felt they could do some good by speaking out. Blame swirled. Too many guns were the problem, said one faction.